Thanks for a very warm welcome to Dharmadipa. Dharmadipa lives at Padmaloka, which is the men's ordination retreat centre up on the outskirts of Norwich, a place where many of us on the men's side have been, and indeed some of the women, because some of them saw me get ordained there, so you will know of what we're speaking. I've known Dharmadipa since, I guess, about 2008 when I first went to Padmaloka. I'm not sure when you got ordained.
94,
so quite a long time ago. And Dharmadipa spends his life really training men in ordination, which is a fantastic thing to do. I'm always inspired to go to Padmaloka and see Dharmadipa and the rest of the community who live and teach at Dharmadipa and have helped people like myself through the ordination process and bring us into the order. So it's a wonderful thing to spend your life doing, very inspiring. Thank you for coming.
Okay, so I was asked, or it was suggested, that I talk about the Heart Sutra, because as far as I understand, you're doing a series on the Sevenfold Puja at the moment, and Heart Sutra will be on today. I must admit, it was a bit of my heart sank when I heard about it, because it's actually initially not my favorite text, the Heart Sutra. So I thought, okay, I'll do it anyway. And just to say, I know most of you know the puja, I think some don't, so I hope I could take you with me as I talk. It could well be that we notice, as I talk about the Heart Sutra, that this is beyond us, spiritually speaking. It's okay. I'm going to talk about things which are beyond us, not because we are stupid or unintelligent enough, but because we're too selfish. And this is how we are, so yeah, too self-centered. So I don't think it's actually intellectually too very complicated text, well, it is in some ways, but it's more spiritually demanding. So just to give the context, so everybody knows where we are. So we've got the Sevenfold Puja, our basic ritual, one of our basic rituals in Triratna, which describes, in a way, you go through a series of stages of spiritual emotions, which hopefully prepare us to develop the wish to gain enlightenment for the sake of all beings. So it's a text which is firmly embedded in the Bodhisattva ideal, in the idea you don't practice for yourself at all. You practice for the welfare of others. That's the whole background of the puja. Yeah, it's not about you. It's about other people. So I think it's important to understand the whole, everything we do when we talk about the puja in this context. Yeah. I'm going to come back to this. And we go through different stages. So there's veneration, going for refuge. So we decide to go for refuge. Once we go for refuge with the Buddha, Dhamma, and Sangha, we notice everything which holds us back. So we confess. When we confess, we're free to rejoice in others' merits, and so on. And then comes a stage entreaty and supplication. So at this stage, we're hopefully emotionally open enough to take in the Buddha's teachings. This is verse describing this emotion. Then usually in a puja, we have a reading. So somebody reads a text from the Buddhist scriptures. And then we all recite the Heart Sutra together. That's how the puja goes. Now, in some ways, there's something problematic about the Heart Sutra. I think it can be read in a not helpful way. And I think it is sometimes seen in a not very helpful way. Actually, sometimes have fantasies of just of banning it from the puja. One thing, it's a perfection of wisdom text. So it's all about emptiness, which can... It's a genre of texts which are dangerous because they can bring out the worst in us. It lends itself to useless, clever theory and just sort of theorizing about philosophy and science. So one danger is it all gets in the head. Clever talk with no significance. Yeah. That's one of the dangers. And Westerners are great at that. Yeah. So it could just be a bit of a waste of time, intellectual game, which doesn't mean anything. But we feel very clever because we talk about Buddhism and perfection of wisdom. One danger. The other danger, it's all connected, is because it talks about emptiness a lot and everything being empty, nihilism. Yeah, that we think non-existence is more real than existence, and things don't really exist. That's very dangerous in the Buddhist context. Yeah, if you go down that route, that's not good. Yeah, so the danger of nihilism. And also, there's a sort of something about the position which can be misunderstood. So we've got the reading from the Buddhist scriptures, which is word of the Buddha, and then the Heart Sutra is of perfection of wisdom. So it could be read in a way that we've got the reading from the Buddha scriptures, but then the Heart Sutra says, well, yeah, it's all very nice, but it's all empty. Yeah. So the danger is then we don't take the reading seriously enough, because the Heart Sutra says all these teachings are empty. So there are certain dangers associated with the text. Okay, so what I do now, I want to sort of suggest a way of reading the sutra, the Heart Sutra, which is a bit associative. So I hope I point out when I'm just being associative and not scholarly proven, but just a way for me to make sense of the text. And just in terms of the title, a bit of background. So the word for heart in Heart Sutra, it's not citta or so, which is usually translated heart, but it's hridaya, which means more core. So when it says Heart Sutra, it doesn't mean feeling, but it means core, the core of wisdom. It was very likely composed in China, in Chinese, and then translated into Sanskrit, the Indian language. I think what happened was basically the text was around in China, and then some of the early Chinese translators went to India to find the texts, and they couldn't find an Indian version of the Heart Sutra. But they knew there had to be one because the view was everything's come from India. So they couldn't find it. So they translated it back into Sanskrit, into Indian language. Yeah. Because they assumed it must be there. But actually, I think it never was Indian. It was actually, it's a Chinese text, apparently. Okay, so it's a bit of background. So I want to try to look at the text. So the sutra starts with the bodhisattva of compassion when he meditated deeply, and so on. So bodhisattva of compassion, that's Avalokiteshvara. So I want to talk a bit about the fact that it's Avalokiteshvara, the bodhisattva of compassion, who speaks the sutra. Now, this could be a complete coincidence, an almost historical accident. Because different sutras, different Mahayana sutras, are associated with different bodhisattvas and historical figures. And sometimes that may be just coincidence. So there may not be, not be a deeper meaning in this, but let's just assume there is, for the sake of this talk. So maybe it helps to read the text in a particular way if we look at who Avalokiteshvara is. The simple answer, which we all know, bodhisattva of compassion, which is very glib and easy, but it doesn't tell us much. So he's associated with compassion, with the quality of compassion. But I think it's more, I find it more interesting to look at the mythology around Avalokiteshvara, because I think that gives a hint how you can read the Heart Sutra. In some of the mythology around Avalokiteshvara, he is depicted as making the vow to work only for the benefit of others and not have any selfish thought at all. If he would do so, he would explode to 1,000 pieces. Yeah. That's the origin story of the 1,000-armed Avalokiteshvara. So you could say the mythology of Avalokiteshvara, or the story behind Avalokiteshvara, is complete selflessness. Any selfish thought would be wrong. Any thought about one's own well-being would be a failure from this point of view. So that's the myth of Avalokiteshvara. It's not a balanced way of practicing, you may notice. It's not a balanced way of practicing. It's more like fully do this completely impossible task and probably going to fail at it, which he did. But that's the path. Yeah. So there's no mentioning of looking after oneself in the myth. Yeah. No mentioning of making sure one's okay. Yeah. No idea of being balanced and sort of not too extreme. It's actually a very extreme way of practicing. It's very extreme. Yeah. But that's the way to practice. If you follow the myth of Avalokiteshvara. He brings some interesting ideas about balanced practice. So it's from that point of view, following the myth of Avalokiteshvara is actually terrifying, dangerous, and destructive. Yeah, it's not sort of cuddly and nice. I don't think Avalokiteshvara is sort of cuddly and nice bodhisattva. Yeah? If you follow that myth properly, you aim to a mental state which is not about you at all. Yeah, that's what we try to get at. So next time you recite the Avalokiteshvara mantra, bear that in mind. This also connects it with the Sevenfold Puja. So this puja we are reciting is from a text called Bodhicharya Avatara by Shantideva. And if you look at the text of the whole book where our puja is taken from, it's all about altruism and not practicing for yourself. Even the chapters on mindfulness is only interesting insofar as you have an effect on other people. And insofar your mental states are of an ethical or unethical value. Yeah. So when he talks about mindfulness, you may be horribly disappointed because he doesn't talk about mindfulness of the body, only insofar as your actions have impact on others. That's the only way he talks about mindfulness. Yeah. So it's an interesting way of practicing. It all fits with the myth of Avalokiteshvara, yeah? And the whole mind train tradition which comes out of that. So what this is saying is another way of looking at the fact that the problem of suffering, according to Buddhism, is self-clinging. Yeah? It's being overly interested in oneself, which is actually the problem. Yeah? Self-clinging, and the term is cling. It's not about a metaphysical idea of what self is, it's about clinging, yeah? Which is the problem. Yeah? That's what it's getting at. It's a problem for us, and it causes problems for others. That's why he says, the Bodhisattva of compassion, when he meditated deeply, saw the emptiness of all five skandhas and sundered the bonds that caused him suffering. So in a way, seeing the emptiness of person destroys suffering. Okay, that's the beginning of the sutra. Then comes the whole section of form is no other than emptiness, emptiness no other than form, and so on. Feeling, thought, and choice, consciousness itself are the same as this. So one thing about the term emptiness. I found actually a seminar extract by Bhante where he says the term emptiness or voidness is not very helpful because it means different things in different contexts. Yeah. So when he says emptiness of the person is different from emptiness of enlightenment, different from emptiness of the mind and so on. So in itself, to say everything is empty is completely meaningless, because you have to know empty of what. Yeah. So it gets a bit complicated there. The other danger is that the term emptiness sounds like non-existence, you know, that things don't exist. So another formulation for emptiness is everything arises in dependence upon conditions and is therefore impermanent. That's what emptiness means. So emptiness does not mean non-existence. I think it's really important. Otherwise, you get it completely wrong, I think. Yeah. What emptiness is a different formulation of basic Buddhist condition co-production. Every phenomenon arises in dependence upon conditions. When the conditions change, this phenomenon ceases to exist. Therefore, it is empty of independent self-existence. Yeah. So nothing has independent, autonomous self-existence. That's what emptiness means. It does not mean things don't exist. I mean, obviously, things do exist. Mm. That would be denying all our experience. I mean, I exist. I mean, I know it. I feel it. Yeah? But I don't exist independent and permanent. So whenever we hear the term emptiness, that's what's meant. It's sort of empty of autonomous existence without any conditions. Okay, so the first five things which are empty are the five skandhas: form, feeling, thought, choice, consciousness. That is one of the formulations of the personality. So when we say that the root problem in Buddhism is clinging to oneself, one way of looking at this self which we cling to is, so if we divide into small bits to make sure we don't leave anything out. Yeah? And one way of doing that is the five skandhas. Yeah? It's basically a way of dividing the personality into smaller bits. So there are form, which roughly speaking says the body, sort of. Feeling, which is actually, this term is more Vedana, it's actually more whether something is pleasant, unpleasant, or neutral. So it's very basic feeling. It's a basic pleasant, unpleasant, neutral. Thought is actually recognition. So we recognize something. Choice is volition. So we want something. That's more like our feelings and emotions. And consciousness itself, the idea of being the observer of that. So that's us. Yeah. So there's always, we've got the body. Because in the sense impressions, there's always a feeling tone to it. It's pleasant or unpleasant. We always think about something. We have an idea about something. And volition is always there. We always want to do something or not to do something. And we have the idea of the person behind of that. That's consciousness. So that's us. Yeah. And what the Heart Sutra says, these are empty. Again, that does not mean they don't exist. Yeah. So when we come to body, it doesn't mean the body doesn't exist, but the body is actually a changeable object. Yeah. It arises because of conditions, and when the conditions change, the body will cease. In other words, we will get old, sick, and we're going to die. That's in a sense what emptiness of the body is about. Yeah? Don't cling to your body. Yeah? Its point is to cling to your body because it does things it shouldn't be doing. Yeah? Yeah, they get old, so don't be surprised when you get older. And that's attractive. At least, yeah, it may be disappointing, but actually, yeah, that's guaranteed. Yeah, it's just clear. Yeah. And less fit. Feelings, and again, it does not mean feelings don't exist, but any feeling we have is actually arises out of conditions and it will disappear. Yeah. So again, just be aware of our, we should be aware of our feelings, but they're not the truth about the world. Because we don't see that any mood we're in is sort of returned to the world view. Yeah? So in a bad mood, so the world is bad. In a good mood, the world is good. It's just changing moods. Yeah? So again, when it says feelings and choice or volitions are empty, it means don't get too interested in your feelings. Yeah, they're interesting ones, feelings, but they come and go. So don't get too absorbed in them, not too obsessive about them. Don't cling to them. And don't, at this point, don't identify with them. That's the important thing. Because what happens is we identify with the current state we're in and think this is me and this is the world. Yeah, so that's the emptiness of the skandhas. Then comes this other bit, which is, I'm not quite sure what it's doing there anyway. The all things are by nature void. They are not born or destroyed, nor are they stained or pure, nor do they wax or wane. Things is dharmas, which in this context was tiniest things. So it would be, for example, thought moments. So when we look at the mind, in general, we've got the skandhas, as feelings, thoughts, and so on. At more detail, any of those feelings, thoughts, ideas, volitions, consist of tiny bits. You can see feelings of changing. Just tiny moments of, we have just tiny moments of consciousness following each other. And when enough of them are similar to each other, we call it a particular feeling. So again, it looks at it in much more detail. And because they are by nature void, they have no self-existence, they are not born or destroyed, nor stained or pure, nor do they arise or wane. So there's categories which don't... If everything is process, maybe that's the way of looking at it, if everything is process, you can't talk about things arising and ceasing. That's when not born or destroyed. Yeah? Because there's this process going on. So this goes a bit deeper. Then it continues. I mean, this is going to be a very superficial race through the Heart Sutra, I'm afraid. Then he comes back to the skandhas. Therefore, where there's emptiness, there's neither form nor feeling, and so on. Maybe a rephrasing from the point of view of wisdom, we can't talk about body feelings existing as independent. Yeah. So again, it comes back to the five skandhas, so the personality under the heading of the five skandhas, and says, from the point of view of conditioned co-production, of process, impermanence, we can't really speak of any of those things existing in a firm way. Again, so let go of them. I mean, the whole mood is letting go, not clinging, not getting caught up in things. That's the whole mood of the Heart Sutra, I think. It's all about not getting caught up in things. It's about not getting caught up in oneself. And the first category he uses is the five skandhas. Then comes the bit, no eye, ear, nose, tongue, body, mind, no form, sound, smell, taste, touch, or what the mind takes hold of, nor even act of sensing. These are the six senses, the five body senses and the mind. So I think what's happening here is, so we have first look at the personality under the heading of the five skandhas, which is more about me, yeah, my body, my feelings. What he does with the six senses, he looks at the personality from the point of view of relating to the outside world. Yeah. So we believe in a really existing listener who listens to really existing sounds out there, and so on. Whereas what this says, no, there's only sense impressions happening. So it's another way of looking at non-self, but from the point of view of relating to the outside world, to the senses. It's six senses because the mind is used as a sense. That's not very magical. I think it's quite straightforward. If you look at something unpleasant, you feel aversion. If you look at something pleasant, you feel craving. If you think about something unpleasant, you feel aversion. If you think about something pleasant, you feel craving. So the mechanism is the same, whether it's mind-made or physical object. Is that clear? Yeah. So from that point of view, mind is a sense. It doesn't mean mind reading or anything. It's just what happens with the physical senses, which is basically we see, hear, or taste something, we find it pleasant or unpleasant, and then we develop craving or aversion. It's the same in the mind. I mean, we do it in the metta-bhavana. Yeah? We think about the enemy and think of the terrible person, and then we try to develop metta. So again, emptiness of the person or non-clinging to the person from the point of view of the senses. I think it's a teaching which I find quite fascinating to work with the senses. I think we don't do enough with it in Triratna, is my impression. It's not very well developed. But I can recommend it. I mean, just sort of spend some time just listening to sounds and see what happens. Really fascinating. Seeing the change a bit of sounds and all that. So, yeah, another way of looking at the self through the six senses. Then comes this bit. No ignorance or end of it, no all that comes of ignorance. No withering, no death, no end of them. Does anybody know what that refers to, by the way? Uh-huh. No surprise. It is the 12 Nidanas. It's a shortcut for the 12 Nidanas, the ones you find at the outer thing of the Wheel of Life. So it's basically a shortcut. The 12 Nidanas start with ignorance and end with decay and death. And then you've got all the steps in between. What the text is doing, it sort of shortens them. I think it assumes we know that. I think it's a problem. The text assumes we know what the 12 Nidanas are. So what they are, it's another big talk in itself, but very briefly, I think what the 12 Nidanas are is another look at the personality, but this time throughout time. I mean, I simplify horribly now. Yeah. So the 12 Nidanas describe very briefly, simplified, what we are now is the result of our past habits, which condition how we respond to the world. Yeah. And that conditions what sort of life we're going to lead. So this looks at the person throughout time. Yeah, we are the result of our past, and how we act now will have effect on our future. This is very simple in one sentence what the 12 Nidanas are about. And much more to it, but just for the sake of this, I think I leave it there. So again, another way of looking at the personality. Yeah. So we have the five skandhas, sort of analyzing oneself, the senses, how we relate to the outside world, and now we've got the personality as existing throughout time. Yeah, being that we are the result of the past and we're going to create the future through our actions. And again, these are empty. So these are obviously processes. Doesn't mean they don't exist, but they don't have self-existence. You also have their disappearance being empty. So here we come into sort of Buddhist practice in a way, because if you don't do all this, it's a bit like, well, that would be enlightenment if you don't do the 12 nidanas. But even the disappearance is empty in a sense of dependent upon conditions. Then there's a section. Nor is there pain or cause of pain or ceasing pain or noble path to lead from pain. These are the four noble truths. Yeah, so another Buddhist teachings in there. Which is the, probably, it could be seen as the most basic formulation of Buddhism. I think it's historically probably the most important formulation of the Dharma. Again, I think in Triratna we don't do it fully justice, I think, my impression. It's not much talked about the Four Noble Truths. But they're extreme summary. So the first two, pain and the cause of pain, describe samsara, the non-enlightened state. The suffering and the causes for it, which is craving. Ceasing pain or noble path to lead from pain describes the Buddhist life and enlightenment. Ceasing pain is enlightenment. The noble path to lead from pain is all our Buddhist practices. So we've got the whole thing there, the whole of Buddhism in these four statements. And I think, again, when it talks about the emptiness of them, I think I'm really guessing here, I'm not quite clear. I suspect what it's getting at, that the Buddhist teachings which we follow are not dogmas, but practices. I think it's another, so when we talk of emptiness of the teachings, it means we use them as practices for a purpose and not as sort of dogmas to apply all the time blindly. I think it's what's getting at. I'm not entirely sure. Then comes the bit, not even wisdom to attain, attainment too is emptiness. The translation we're using in Triratna is, by the way, very used by Zen. We got it from a Zen group somewhere. I've got Khonsa's translation here, which is more precise. What he says, there's no cognition, which I think is his translation for wisdom, no attainment and no non-attainment. And then comes the next bit, which I think sort of belongs to this. So know that the Bodhisattva holding to nothing whatever. The full translation is, therefore, owing to a Bodhisattva's indifference to any kind of personal attainment. That seems to be what it's about. So I think what he's saying is don't get caught up in any ideas of attainment in your Buddhist life. It is tempting. We all want to know where we are. Am I a stream entered or not? It's such and such a stream. Highly interesting. But what this is saying is don't even be interested in your own process. Don't even bother about where you are on the path. Yeah? Even that would be, it's not very helpful anyway, I think. Yeah? But we can get all, worked up about where am I on the path, how far developed am I, how far developed is so-and-so. I want to make sure I'm with a teacher who's far developed because it's better for me and some of his wisdom may rub up on me. So we can get all caught up in sort of thinking about attainments in the Buddhist life. So I think this bit in the Heart Sutra addresses sort of how we deal with the idea of goals and attainment. Now obviously it doesn't mean that one should not care about getting anywhere with the Buddhist life. I think there should be a yearning and striving for enlightenment, and a sort of desire for enlightenment. I think we need that. Yeah? But I think where it becomes dangerous when we get caught up in the question, where am I on the path? Yeah? Then we get all very strange and I don't think very helpful, actually. It's not very helpful to think in those terms. Actually, I realized myself, I did on a solitary a while ago, that one of my great causes for anxiety, I've got many, one of my great causes for anxiety is the question, is my practice going well? And can get really sort of caught up in it. Is my practice good enough or not? And I decided that's anxiety, so I decided not to bother too much about this question. It was great, actually, much more relaxing. So I took the decision, I just try not to be interested in how I'm doing spiritually speaking, which makes life much easier and one can just get on with one's practice. So I suspect, because the translation by Conses, it's about the bodhisattva's indifference to any kind of personal attainment. I don't know how it historically developed, and we don't know much about Buddhist history, really. But you have in early Buddhism all these stages of attainment, the stream entrant, one's return and non-return, aren't. And it can get a bit technical. And then you can wonder, where am I on this? I think it's all a bit technical and quite dry in a way. And it seems what part of the later developments which stress the bodhisattva ideal, what they seem to be doing is saying, that's not interesting. Don't get too interested in this. The tradition which follows on from the Shantideva text, where our puja is from, the Bodhisattva, they developed this further, this idea, and I don't know where I got the quote from, I must find it again. But it's the path of altruism is a path without stages, because you're not interested in where you are. So if your practice is only about benefiting others, it's a path without any stages and attainments, because any idea of stages and attainment is about yourself. So there's something quite relaxing about the whole idea of it. So anybody too goal-oriented or too worried about their own spiritual status, I think it's quite helpful to think in those terms. And we don't even know how we're doing anyway. I think another point is we are so complicated. We're incredibly complicated beings. The idea of a linear progression in the Buddhist life, I don't think it actually works. And the more we practice, maybe speaking for myself more, the more I realize how complicated I am. In some ways, it's sort of really inspired and practicing. But sometimes, at the same time, almost, you can be incredibly immature. I think we have all these, even after years and years of practice, we have all these feelings, emotions, and stuff which we think we should have grown out of, but we haven't. Sometimes I wonder whether I'm getting worse as I keep practicing. I wonder whether I'm getting worse, actually. So anybody who looks for an inspiring person, don't ask me. Don't waste my time. So I think it comes with practice. If you have a very, very simplistic, linear idea of development, I develop further in all ways, it's not going to happen. I don't think it's going to happen. It's because it's extremely complicated. We're extremely complicated beings. So that makes the whole question of having attained anything even more complicated. So yes, there is this bit. Know that the bodhisattva holding to nothing whatever, but dwelling in prajna wisdom, is freed of delusive hindrance, rid of the fear bred by it, and reaches clearest nirvana. I just read the Konsa translation, which I think is more precise, but less easy to understand. Therefore, owing to a bodhisattva's indifference to any kind of personal attainment, and through his having relied upon the perfection of wisdom, he dwells without thought coverings. In the absence of thought coverings, he has not been made to tremble. He has overcome what can upset, in the end sustained by nirvana. I'm not quite sure what translates as thought coverings. You don't know the half of Sanskrit, but...
Sometimes mind obstructions.
Mind obstructions, yeah. So I think it's sort of unnecessary mental activity. I think it was getting at. And that helps you to get rid of the fear. So I think the way I connect with it, the way I read it, is that most of our anxiety or fear, I mean, it's a very... pull it down a few levels now. most of our anxiety and fear comes from too much thinking. Yeah? And even thinking about attainment is another subtle way of getting anxious. So I think that's what it's getting at. So the complete absence of any unnecessary thought is probably also the absence of anxiety and fear. But we're talking here of a very deep level, yeah, on the level of enlightenment. I don't think it's talking about fear in the psychological sense only. Yeah. I don't think it's talking about fear and anxiety on the psychological level, but more on the almost existential level. I think it's on the existential level of being a person, being alive, and the fear connected with that. All Buddhas of past and present, Buddhas of future time, using this prajna wisdom, come to full and perfect vision. Konsa translates it as all those who appear as Buddhas in the three periods of time, fully awake to the utmost, right and perfect enlightenment, because they have relied upon the perfection of wisdom. So he talks about the Buddhas of the three times, of the Buddhas of the past, present, and future. Again, it's another category which we don't make much of in Theravada, unfortunately. I think they're quite an interesting category. When he talks about the Buddhas of the past, present, and future, it's almost a reminder of the fact that Buddhahood appears in the universe whenever the conditions are right. So that the enlightenment of the Buddha is not some historical human event alone, but it's of something which happens, it's almost part of the nature of the cosmos, of reality, that whenever the conditions are right, a Buddha will appear. And I think what happens here in the text is he's saying the teachings of the Heart Sutra, the teachings of wisdom, are not only a historical event. They're not sort of, they point at a universal truth about the universe. Yeah. So when he talks about Buddhas in the past, present, future, relying on these teachings, it means the Buddhist teachings, the teachings of wisdom, have to do with the nature of the universe. They're not an historical event in India. Yeah. So it sort of makes them bigger. And there's never any mentioning about the Buddhas being empty, which is interesting. So the text can be read in a nihilistic way, that everything doesn't exist. But the Buddhas are not. They are still there. Yeah. So when we think about emptiness in Buddhism, there are actually beings who realize this. So when we look into emptiness, it doesn't mean a bland nothingness. It's actually there are people, Buddhas, who live according to that. So they don't disappear. I think that's the point. Then it ends with the, then comes the mantra. Here then the great Dharani, the radiant peerless mantra, the Prajna Paramita, whose words allay all pain. Here in belief is truth, in the Gan mantra. I just read Konsa's translation. I quite like it. Therefore, one should know the Prajna Paramita as the great spell. He translates mantra as spell. Okay. The spell of great knowledge, the utmost spell, the unequaled spell, a layer of all suffering. In truth, for what could go wrong? By the Prajna Paramita has this spell been delivered. It runs like this. And then the mantra, Gate Gate Para Gate Para Samgate Bodhi Swaha, which roughly translates as gone, gone, gone beyond, gone altogether beyond. Oh, what an awakening, all hail, or success. We could, of course, so we've got the mantra at the end, and one can, if one wants, correlate the parts of the mantra to the different levels of emptiness. I think it works, but I think far more important is what I call the mood of the mantra, which is a continuous deepening of letting go. Yeah? So rather than sort of, I mean, I'm not too keen on correlating everything with everything, I find that can be a bit deadening. Yeah? But looking more at the mood of the Prajna Paramita mantra, the perfection of wisdom mantra, is a deepening letting go, gone, gone, gone beyond, gone altogether beyond, enlightenment. So again, I think it's a bit of crystallization of what the whole text is about in sort of one line, which is all about the mood of letting go. So this is the mantra, the very briefly and hopelessly simplified, the text. But again, in this context of the puja, although it's called the perfection of wisdom and the highest text, it's not the end. Because after the Heart Sutra comes the transference of merit and self-surrender, which is about giving yourself to all beings. So I think the position of the Heart Sutra and the readings means, another way of looking at it, wisdom in terms of letting go, non-self, letting go of self, is only good if we then because only then we are free for real compassion. So the whole idea of insight, wisdom, perfection of wisdom, emptiness, non-self, and all that is a means to an end. And the end is actually compassion. Yeah? And that's how I connect it with the whole myth of Avalokiteshvara. Yeah? That seeing the emptiness of everything, which means not clinging to anything. It's the not clinging to anything that actually enables us to be of benefit for others. So I think this is how the Heart Sutra fits into the whole Sevenfold Puja. Okay, so that was a brief overview of the Heart Sutra.